Well, Robert Trzynski writes about Bill Fretza. Bill has lived this history. Started as an engineer with Bell Labs, straight out of MIT. The story he has to tell is that the Internet, as we know it, was born out of the breakup of the AT&T monopoly in 1982. Specifically, the Internet grew out of rejecting the very policies that are the backbone of net neutrality. AT&T gained its monopoly, ironically, from a settlement called the Kingsbury Commitment. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not.
That headed off an antitrust prosecution. In effect, the government agreed that instead of breaking up AT&T, it would give the government's backing to its monopoly. In exchange, AT&T agreed to become a regulated utility. The cornerstones of that deal were universal service, a telephone for everyone, no matter where he lived, and equality. As Fretza puts it, the commitment was, quote, "People will be equal before the telephone. Not only will the guy out there on a farm in Idaho get a phone, he's going to pay the same prices as a city slicker, even though the city slicker lives in a 100-unit apartment building across the street from the central office." Close quote. Fretza describes how the slow pace of innovation earlier wasn't just a result of AT&T being a big, complacent, government-protected monopoly. It was specifically a result of the proto-net neutrality requirements of universality and equality. AT&T couldn't introduce a new service unless it could introduce it for everyone equally. That sounds like a dumb way to allow something to grow, doesn't it?
It reminds me of the 1928 presidential campaign slogan from Herbert Hoover: "A chicken in every pot and a car in every garage."
A phone on every wall.
That's exactly right. And it's going to cost everybody the same, regardless of who you are, where you live, and you're all going to have exactly the same need and requirements.
Well, Fretza describes how this held back the development of an internet-style data transmission system. Mm-hmm. If it has to be available on every pair of copper wires, including the five-mile loop with the load coils going out to the farmer, well, you can't push more than 9,600 baud through. Mm-hmm. For those who don't remember this antiquated terminology, 9,600 baud is 9,600 bits per second, which is not just a dial-up connection, but a particularly slow connection. Today we talk about speeds in megabits. And then he says, in effect, what AT&T was not allowed to do was to employ the business model that Silicon Valley and the modern Internet was built on, targeting new technology at the early adopter. The tech enthusiast who wants to be on the bleeding edge and is willing to pay a lot of extra money for something that doesn't necessarily work all that well. Now, here's Trzynski's conclusion. I want to see if you agree with this. That's why we should be thrilled to see Internet service providers contemplating internet fast lanes to charge extra for massive data users like Netflix. This would set off a gold rush of investment in infrastructure and innovation that would eventually bring us all much higher data transmission speeds. That's what the actual history of the internet shows. The exotic, exorbitantly expensive new technologies of a few years ago eventually become the cheap and ubiquitous technologies of today. This is such a commonplace experience that it's really astonishing that anyone in the tech industry has let themselves be bamboozled by the notion that we'd all be much better off with the business model of a sclerotic, highly regulated public utility. And then the Fretza guy says, this is a tragedy to see people using the same arguments that were used back in 1913 to try to re-regulate the internet. So what's going on here?
I don't agree with that. It's the same concept of having roads. We're talking about transmission, communication. We're talking about moving things. Roads do the same thing in the same type of a manner. As you may be aware, out here in D.C., we have these hot lanes now, right?
Right.
That before, if you had three people in a car for a carpool, you were allowed to go and use them for free. Well, now, regardless of what the public sentiment was, they implemented hot lanes. And for anybody not familiar, a hot lane is something that charges you regardless. You can use it if you have one person, two people, three people. Now, it gives you either a discount or lets you go free in some segments if you have three people or more.
Right.
But anybody else using it has to pay. And there are lots and lots of people that will pay $20 to go 3 miles. It is all about, again, at the end of the day, it's always about the bottom line, which is money. That's all they care about. And they're going to take, and by charging Netflix, for example, more money to be in a hot lane. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you said it was, right? A hot lane?
Something like that, right? Internet hotline.
Yeah. Yeah. So by charging them more.
Fast lane.
It's the same concept. It's the same concept as trickle down economics. The people who are paying for the Netflix service are going to be the ones who are going to be paying for the increased costs associated with this hot lane. It's not going to be the service provider. It's not Netflix. They're not going to absorb all those costs. They're going to push that off to the consumer. That's how economics works, which is why we have these ebbs and flows in the economy so much, you know, where you go through periods of inflation and deflation. Well, not so much deflation in the last, I don't know, 40 years, but we definitely have a situation where the internet is going to get much more expensive for a lot of people, and it's not going to be in the ISP cost or the internet service provider cost that you're going to be paying at the house. That's going to be bundled in. You're going to have massive, you already have massive bandwidth at your house. In case you didn't know it, folks, you have gigabits of capability plugged into your house.
Sure.
The ISP just throttles you back, and then you pay incrementally for more speed, upward and downward speed to the internet. So it's already there. The capability is already there. They don't need to do anything or prepare anything else. And they have these huge cables. I've seen these cables. These things are stinking huge, and they carry stuff all over the country really fast. And they can go internet, obviously, just like you're sitting next door to somebody. The latency is almost nothing. But where you're going to be caught is you're going to be caught with the hidden costs, the Netflix, the Amazons, things like that. That's where the money's going to go, because you're going to see providers of services with those types of services that are all hot-laned having to pay more for their services. So those costs are going to be pushed down to you. And you're going to see electricity costs associated with your systems. All those types of things, they're going to go up in cost. So you're not going to see a direct cost. It's going to be like a hidden tax you're going to be paying for net neutrality.
So now the current rules, we have a form of net neutrality today, don't we? Did they pass, yes, under Obama? Didn't they pass some rules back in 2011 or something?
Yes, that's right. It's almost transparent to what you saw in 2010, because the lack of enforceability is one aspect of it. And the other aspect is that what we agreed to was very limited, very minimal. But this aspect of net neutrality would be, I think it would be a real mess. I'm not going to say disastrous, destroy the economy, because you can't destroy something that's already destroyed. So you are looking at consumers paying a lot more for services that they're currently paying a lot less for right now. And Congress is looking at repealing the net neutrality restrictions that were put in place back in 2011 also. There's a bill on the floor in the House right now about that.
So should they repeal it?
This aspect of it, yeah, I think they should. I think the whole net neutrality concept is a socialist concept that pretty much forces everybody into accepting the government's answer to what information is, and accepts the government answer to who's allowed to have high speed, low speed internet, who is going to be sorted. When you do a DNS lookup, when you do let me talk English, like a Google search.
Sure.
If you're looking for something in Google, what are the top lines? It's not going to be according to tagline anymore. It's going to be there's going to be a new tag put into the headers that's going to identify their net neutrality status. So if they're, if it's a Netflix or something like that, they'll be sorted differently than if they're, RT, Russian Times article. Google will get precedence over Russian times. It's a complete regulation of information that is presented to you in the fastest and easiest manner, as opposed to a general indexing of information.
Okay, well, I got to say this. We got a couple of minutes left, then we got to go. But I got to say this. Whatever rules are in place that have allowed, indeed, paved the way for Google and Facebook to now control 83% of all online advertising revenue. Google, let me repeat that. Google and Facebook own 83% of all online advertising revenue. Mm-hmm. Whatever has allowed that needs to end. That's what needs to go.
That's individual choice. People choose to use Google. People choose to use Facebook. And that's why the advertisers go to those locations and advertise there, because people spend a lot of time on those sites. Pure and simple. If you went to, you know, if you use DuckDuckGo more often as a search engine,
sure,
then you would see more advertisers trying to leverage DuckDuckGo, even though it's a closed search engine, right, and doesn't do indexing. So it's more open, free, but people are not aware of that, so people use what they're familiar with. It's another psychology thing, or sociology. People in large groups tend to act stupid, and they do the same thing that all the other stupid people do, so they all use Google.